Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am thrilled to have with me today one of my colleagues and an international expert on pain, Dr. Stephen Cohen. Dr. Cohen is the chief of pain medicine here at Johns Hopkins and a professor of anesthesiology here at Johns Hopkins and at the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences. He is incredibly well published and respected throughout the world for his work on chronic pain. And we are, I think, really lucky to have him here to talk about it today. And what we're going to do is talk about just a general kind of overview of pain, what it is, what the different aspects of it are, and what kind of things are being done to try to address it. And then our hope, if we can convince him, is to get Dr. Cohen to come back on subsequent days for subsequent episodes to talk about some specifics within that greater realm of pain. So Dr. Cohen, welcome to the show.
That's the best introduction I could have hoped for, Jed. Thanks.
Well, it's absolutely a pleasure to have you here. So, Steve, actually, before we jump into pain, let me just ask you to say a few words about yourself, kind of what you do. I kind of described it, but just give people a little bit of an idea of what your practice looks like, what your research focuses on, and then how you got where you are now.
Sure, Jed. So I'm the division chief of pain medicine at Johns Hopkins. I have joint faculty appointment at Walter Reed and the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. So I retired as a colonel in the Army Reserve, and I have a son at the Military Academy. I spend about 50% of my time doing clinical work and about 50% of my time doing research. I have a whole bunch of NIH and Department of Defense grants as the principal investigator. The biggest areas of my research are spinal pain, specifically facet joint denervation, epidural steroid injections, conservative measures, and post-traumatic pain.
Great. And Steve, you have obviously written some of the national and even international guidelines and a variety of things in pain. You're really a central figure in the internationally, as I said. If there are listeners sitting out there thinking, that's what I want to be someday, right? I mean, how did you get there? Was it kind of finding your focus in different research areas and then just kind of plugging away until you became the man, or how did it happen?
So I'm actually asked this question quite often. And I wish I had a blueprint that everyone could follow. So you know that we have a lot of very ambitious and accomplished people at Johns Hopkins. Most of them have done, have a PhD or a master's degree, or they did the T32 program. I didn't do any of those. So, I really started to get heavily involved in research after 9/11. And so there was a lot of money. There were a lot of people with pain. One of the most pivotal articles I ever did, no one in pain knows about because it's not primarily a pain article, but we looked at over 40,000 evacuees from Iraq and Afghanistan. So everyone who is evacuated, we categorize them into into reasons such as neurological, combat-related, psychiatric, spinal. There was infectious disease, surgical, non-surgical, cardiac, and pain was always one of the top five. But most importantly, if you had back pain, you were extremely unlikely to ever return to your unit. And so that's an abject failure for the medical corps, because the mission of the medical corps is to restore the fighting force. The only things that had lower return to duty rates than back pain were psychiatric conditions and combat-related injuries. So back in 2007, Ron White and I, we engineered the opening of the first pain clinic ever in Iraq, and we started to do a lot of research. Grants started to come my way. I learned a lot from people like Dr. Raja, and it was really a lot of trial and error, and I had a lot of help along the way.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that. And, you know, I think so much of it is, or does seem to be, when I talk to people like you who've really had incredible success, is one, kind of saying yes to the opportunities that come along and keeping your mind open to be flexible where you may not have been doing things before. And two, really looking for that mentorship, because, you know, I've never met anyone who's achieved incredible success who didn't have really strong mentorship along the way as they built up their own career. So that's great advice. All right. So,
You know, for that article that was published, the cover of a special edition of Lancet back in 2010, Charlie Brown in our department helped out. So at one point he was very interested in going into pain. And this is one thing that I talk about with my son. I said, you know, when people ask you to do something, you know, volunteer, especially, you know, being in the military, if somebody asks you, they're really, you know, I told him I want him to be the first person to raise their hand when they're asking someone for a volunteer. That's really important to be reliable and to take these opportunities.
Yeah, that's great advice. Thanks, Steve. All right. So let's jump in and talk about, and it's a huge question, obviously, but, you know, if you had to kind of define it, what is pain? Let's start really simple. What is pain?
So fortunately, I don't have to define that. That's been defined by the International Association for the Study of Pain as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with or resembling that associated with actual or potential tissue damage.
Okay, so that's what pain is. Now, that's obviously a textbook definition, as you said. It may or may not kind of resonate with people. How do people interpret pain? And what we might be getting into here is the kind of biopsychosocial model of pain. So, you know, kind of give me an idea of what that means. What is that? And how does that kind of make that connection between the textbook definition of pain and what individuals actually experience?
So, great question. So the biopsychosocial model postulates pain and disability as multidimensional dynamic interactions among biological, psychological, and social factors. And these factors reciprocally influence each other. So almost everyone knows that depression, anxiety, poor sleep, and adverse social conditions, things like divorce, you know, can be the result of chronic pain. But what people often don't appreciate is that if you're depressed or anxious, if you don't sleep well, if you don't have a strong social network, and you get injured, that you're more likely to transition to chronic pain from acute pain. So this has really important implications. It also strongly supports an interdisciplinary care model.
Right. So when we say, maybe let's break down each of those pieces. So bio, psycho, and social, right? So bio is the actual biologic tissue damage or whatever it is that's causing the pain. Is that right?
Correct.
And then the psychological part is, as you said, right? The fact that either pain can lead to psychological poor outcomes or having comorbidities psychologically can make you more prone to chronic pain.
It's not just those things that I mentioned, but it's other things such as your coping skills, resilience, whether or not you catastrophize.
Okay. And then social. So these are people's support networks and things like that that impact all of this.
Right. That's correct. So social support networks And they can have positive, they can have negative influences. So we see people, I see it, you know, in my close social network, I see people with enabling behavior sometimes.
And tell me a little more, when you say enabling behavior, what do you mean?
So basically, someone who's close to a patient, I can probably give you a better example. So let's say that someone is very somatically focused on their pain. They're not engaging in physical activity. They won't go out. They're not physically active. These things, they're depressed. They're catastrophizing. So these things are part of a vicious circle. And so some people can say, you know, hey, you got to get out. Let's go for a walk. This isn't the worst thing. You can get over it. And other people really kind of contribute to that. We also see this with opioid use. So sometimes, so there are, we have relatives or spouses of some patients who are misusing opioids, and they're pointing this out and they're saying, you can't do this. We have to draw a red line. And there are others who are, you know, they come into an interview with a patient and they're saying, but you don't understand, doctor. You know, this is the worst pain. You don't understand that without these medications, you know, she can't, you know, my wife or my friend can't function.
Okay. So that's the enabling behavior. Okay. So there are, I'm sure, different categories of pain. If we were going to go through and say what different types of pain there are, what are the categories?
So you can categorize pain many different ways. So you can categorize pain by severity, like on a 0 to 10 pain scale. You can categorize pain by acuity. And that's really important because that's the major determinant for prognosis. So the longer someone has pain, the more difficult it is to treat because of changes that ensue in the nervous system, i.e. neuroplasticity. So acute pain confers evolutionary survival value, while chronic pain is often viewed in both biomedical and biopsychosocial models as a disease by itself. But probably the most important way to classify pain is mechanistically. And that's because categorizing pain this way affects treatment decisions at all levels of care. So nociceptive pain results from activity in neural pathways secondary to actual stimuli or stimuli that might potentially damage tissue. So nociceptive pain is the most common form of chronic pain. It includes post-surgical pain, arthritis, axial low back pain from degenerative conditions. Neuropathic pain is defined by the International Association for the Study of Pain as pain caused by damage or disease affecting the somatosensory system. So compared with neuropathic pain, compared with nociceptive pain, neuropathic pain is typically associated with sensory abnormalities that might occur in the distribution of a nerve or a nerve root, such as numbness, allodynia. It's associated with more prominent pain paroxysms, and there are often focal neurological findings. So examples include diabetic neuropathy, post-herpetic neuralgia, and sciatica. And there's some literature, this is a little controversial, but there's some literature that shows that for the same degree of disease burden or severity, that neuropathic pain is associated with greater decrements in quality of life than nociceptive pain. The newest category of pain is called nociplastic pain. And this is pain that arises from abnormal processing of pain signals without any clear evidence of tissue damage or pathology involving the somatosensory syndrome. So these were previously known as functional pain syndromes. They didn't really fall neatly into one category. They included things like fibromyalgia, irritable back syndrome. Some people even consider migraines and nonspecific back and neck pain to be forms of nociplastic pain. So one of the hallmarks of nociplastic pain is there's no biomarkers, and it's associated with lots of very prominent affective, motivational component of pain. They often have lots of other associated conditions, such as multiple chemical sensitivity. The conditions often co-occur. I think it's also important to state that some people consider that these different categories of pain to represent different points on a pain continuum. So this can explain why NSAIDs, which are not recommended in any guidelines for neuropathic or nociplastic pain, can sometimes be effective for these types of pain. And adjuvants such as anticonvulsants, which are only approved for neuropathic and sometimes nociplastic pain, can in some cases prevent acute pain after surgery. And I'll end by saying that you know, there are many types of pain are actually mixed. For example, sciatica. So nerve involvement in people with lumbar radiculopathy would involve, you know, pain shooting into the leg. The leg might be numb or be associated with paresthesias. But people with sciatica, generally over 80% also have back pain, because the conditions that cause radicular pain, such as a herniated disc or facet joint hypertrophy or spinal canal stenosis, they also cause axial pain. So the disc itself that herniates can cause back pain, but it can also lead to nerve root irritation.
Okay, so that's really helpful. So let me ask you a few questions as we dig into that. One, you mentioned that this is a mechanistic way to describe pain. There's also acuity. Within each of these categories, can you have acute and chronic? I mean, clearly nociceptive pain, you can have acute and chronic. Is it true also for neuropathic and nociplastic pain that you can have acute and chronic types?
Yes, so that's correct. But so a lot of the nociplastic conditions are syndromes, which means that there's not specific pathophysiological mechanisms. So a condition such as a syndrome such as fibromyalgia, we may actually learn in 20 years that it's five different diseases. So some of the nociplastic conditions have time limits on them. So you have to have this condition for 3 months. So for neuropathic pain, clearly you can have nerve injury, you can have a spinal cord injury. During regional anesthesia, somebody can hit a nerve, and you can have neuropathic pain that's acute or chronic.
Okay. So when I think of acute pain, like you said earlier, for nociceptive pain, let's use that as an example, that's very adaptive and very important for survival. In fact, people who can't feel pain don't tend to survive very long, right? Because you need it. You grab that hot kettle, or you step on a hot bed of, you know, coals. Why? Don't know why you would do that, but that any of these things, right? You want your body to react, to feel it, and to pull back. So acute pain in many ways is adaptive. Chronic pain, we think, is not. Is acute, I guess, acute neuropathic pain. I mean, the most acute kind, like you said, would be like someone hits a nerve with a needle while they're doing a procedure. You feel that zing and it's gone as soon as they move the needle. So that's acute, kind of acute and gone. But in the sense of the acute, I guess I think of neuropathic, and certainly, like you were saying, nociplastic is having acute. They can be acute in the sense that they have to start sometime, but they tend to, I think, be more longer lasting. Right? Is that accurate or no?
Right. So obviously, there's lots of factors that go into it. But when somebody twists their ankle, or they have a minor surgical procedure, or they get stung by a bee, most people get better.
Right.
But not everyone. And so in this period of 4 weeks or 6 weeks or 7 weeks, it's sometimes hard to figure out whether these are just slow healers, or is this something qualitatively different? Are they transitioning to chronic pain? Because you might want to use interventions. But after okay. nerve injury,
yeah.
after nerve injury, still, most people will recover if it's not a huge major nerve injury like spinal cord transection. But the chance of transitioning to chronic pain is greater than if it's non-nerve injury. And what really separates you know, there are no separate pathways in your body for neuropathic or nociplastic or nociceptive pain. So what really separates neuropathic pain and nociceptive pain is you don't have transduction. So with transduction, you're directly injuring or stimulating nerves. And with nociceptive pain, you have to transduce maybe a mechanical or a temperature signal into an electrical signal, but also prognosis. Again, after nerve injury, there's a higher chance that a person won't completely get better.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense to me that nociceptive pain, more commonly than neuropathic or nociplastic pain, people will recover from. And these other ones less likely or at least are more likely to go on to chronic pain. So let's talk about that transition. Let's use nociceptive pain, the one people are going to be most familiar with. Do we know why does some injuries go on to develop in chronic pain, whereas that same injury for many other people might just recover and not be an issue?
So this is really important for anesthesiologists and surgeons. So it's multifactorial. So clearly there's a genetic component. So it depends also on the extent of injury. So there are certain types of surgery like thoracotomy or radical mastectomy that are more likely to lead to chronic pain than others. So the extent of injury, whether or not somebody had pain before surgery in that area, and not only in that area, but if you have two people, everything being equal, and one person has three coexisting chronic pain conditions and the other has none, the person with coexisting pain is more likely to not get better after an injury. And that might just be reflective of their nervous system. Their nervous system might be more sensitive. Psychological factors are really important. As I mentioned before, things like post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, depression, coping skills, somatization traits, these are very important predictors. Opioid use. If somebody's on opioids before surgery, they're a lot more likely to have persistent post-surgical pain. And there might be many reasons for that. People might be on opioids because they're more sensitive to pain in general, or because they can't tolerate the same levels of pain. I know that there's some work out from Stanford that shows that people who like opioids more, who have a more euphoric reaction with opioids than people who don't, for the same stimulus, they're more likely to say that they have more pain. And it might be a subconscious psychological thing. And I think most people are aware that opioids can also sensitize one's nervous system, which is called opioid-induced hyperalgesia through its stimulation of NMDA receptors.
Yeah. Okay. And then, you know, I think pain is such a difficult thing, right? If we're talking about kidney injury, you know, you measure something like creatinine and you see that there's kidney injury, right? And the worse the injury, the higher the creatinine. But pain, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the only measurement is subjective, right? You say to someone, how much pain do you have? And they give you a number. And, you know, there's no way there's nothing objective to measure, right? Or am I wrong about that?
So that's a big area of research. That's one of the NIH's top pain research priorities, is to identify biomarkers. So it might be chemokines or cytokines. I guess one of the biggest areas is on functional imaging.
Okay. Yeah. To try to figure out how to quantify this, because ultimately, you know, we say, look, we're compassionate physicians. And if a patient says they're in pain, we want to believe them and treat their pain. I would imagine it makes research difficult, because ultimately, you know, you have a harder time without an objective kind of measurement, which is why, as you say, I think the priority there is to try to find something. Okay. So the transition from acute to chronic, you talked about it's dependent, multifactorial, depends on a lot of things. Is that also true for neuropathic pain? Who's going to have kind of persistent, long-lasting neuropathic pain compared to people who may have, you know, may have some neuropathic pain that then resolves?
That's correct. The risk factors are the same. Although, again, nerve injury is more likely to lead in general to chronic pain than non-nervous tissue injury.
Yeah. Okay. And then what about nociplastic? For example, if somebody has fibromyalgia, is that something you can be cured of and then no longer have it, or are these lifelong conditions?
So we recently published a pain series in Lancet, and one of the articles was on these nociplastic pain conditions. And so for these conditions, because there are no biomarkers, and a lot of them are subjective, so people have to have some of the criteria at a specific time point, like when they're seeing a physician. For example, complex regional pain syndrome type 1, which some people consider to be a form of nociplastic pain, but it's an outlier because there are physical manifestations. But the patient has to have these physical. So there are three symptoms out of four categories and two signs out of the same four categories. And so someone can come in to see me, on Monday, and I can't detect those physical signs. So there's no temperature difference. The color looks the same. And so they don't have the diagnosis of CRPS. But 2 weeks later, when they go see their primary care doctor, they may have those. And so they might. So there's always kind of some inherent subjectivity, I guess, in the diagnosis of these conditions. But when we were looking at some of the cohort studies for these conditions, people often get better. They take a long time to diagnose, so usually much longer. For some of them, it can take years and multiple, or visits to multiple doctors before they're diagnosed. And like I say, one of the problems with the nociplastic conditions is because they're syndromes, they tend to be syndromes and not diseases. There are no specific mechanisms. So it's not like someone who has pneumonia, we can identify a bacteria, we can give them an antibiotic, or they have an autoimmune condition, we can give them, immunosuppressive therapy. So it's widely accepted that mechanism-based treatment of pain is superior to disease or etiologic or symptom-based treatment of pain. The problem with these nociplastic conditions is there's no really distinct pathophysiological mechanisms. Even in practice, it's really hard to, everyone says mechanism-based treatment of pain is better. We know this, it's self-evident, some people say, but for a frontline physician, it's really hard, sometimes impossible, to identify specific mechanisms.
And so when you say mechanistic treatment of pain, give me an example.
So if you have nerve injury, there's often proliferation of sodium channels, near the DRG around the peripheral nerve. So if we could identify those specific sodium channels and then administer sodium channel blockers, then that would be an example of mechanistic-based treatment of pain. Or if somebody had shingles and they have, so people with neuropathic pain often have allodynia. So pain to normally non-painful stimuli. But there's different mechanisms that people could have allodynia. You can have something like a phenotypic switch where A-beta fibers, which normally transmit light touch, they're transmitting light touch, but there's reorganization in the spinal cord. So that's perceived as painful. Or you could just have lower pain thresholds to mechanical stimuli. And so for people who have that, like allodynia, evoke pain, lower pain thresholds, we might be able to put a lidocaine patch on it. That might work very well. But it wouldn't work well when allodynia is from reorganization in the central nervous system.
Right. Okay. So that's what you mean by mechanistic treatment. Then that makes a lot of sense.
All right. Stay with us. We'll be right back and we'll talk about treatment modalities for different types of pain.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, we're back with Dr. Steve Cohen.
So let's go through and see if you can give me some examples of treatment modalities for different mechanistic types of pain. So let's start with nociceptive, right? I mean, there's clearly medications, and those include everything from Tylenol, ibuprofen, other NSAIDs through opiates. And there are other treatments, but how do you think about the treatment modalities for nociceptive pain?
So again, nociceptive pain is a very broad category, so it really depends. But NSAIDs are often considered to be effective treatment, but they have lots of side effects. So NICE from the UK recently came out with guidelines, and the only medication that they recommended were antidepressants. The only medication class they recommended were antidepressants. And when we came out with the series, there were a couple of editorials. One was on the NICE guidelines, and people from the United Kingdom said, this is problematic. It's not consistent with personalized medicine. So NSAIDs, people with acute spinal pain, muscle relaxants may be effective. They have increased muscle tension. Opioids can be effective, and this doesn't include things like nerve blocks.
Right.
Interventions.
Opioids is a big topic. Obviously, you could easily do an entire episode on that. But you said before, being on opiates before, for example, surgery makes you more likely to develop chronic pain. I think there's a lot of thought that chronic use of opiates can actually cause hyperalgesia, but you'll tell me if I'm wrong about that. How do we think of opiates? Good for kind of a short course for acute pain, but not good for chronic pain? How do you think about opiates for treatment of nociceptive pain?
So 15 years ago, you would see it written frequently that neuropathic pain is less responsive to opioids than nociceptive pain. That's probably not true. Later research. So opioids are clearly the gold standard by which everything is compared for acute pain. My opinion, and we wrote something maybe 2 years ago, a commentary, a short review in Mayo Clinic Proceedings with Mike Hooten, who's a pain doctor and an anesthesiologist and a psychiatrist. And it was called The Pill and the Pendulum. And so the premise was that, we have all these different tools in our toolbox, and I think a good physician needs to be able to utilize, all of these tools. So for some people, opioids are the only thing that will help with chronic pain. So Nora Volkow, who's the director of NIDA at the, at the NIH, says, in well-selected candidates, the incidence of addiction is definitely less than 8%. And there's a whole bunch of other systematic reviews, and they say it's probably somewhere about 5%. But it's not 5% across the board. So when somebody has a risk, you have to understand like odds ratios and risk ratio. It might be the risk of developing aberrant drug-seeking behavior or addiction might be 40 or 50% in certain populations. Young people, risk-taking, those with poorly controlled concomitant psychiatric conditions, people with a family history. And it also depends on the drug, because there are certain people who like certain drugs more than others. And then in other people, the risk might be pretty close to zero. The problem is being able to stratify that risk, and then you can make an informed decision. So I use opioids in a pretty small percentage of my population after they've failed, other more conservative treatments. I risk stratify them, and they have to be really low on the risk stratification. I have to have specific benchmarks for success. I have an exit strategy. These are our goals. If we don't meet them, then, this is the strategy that we're going to use. We may go up higher. We may switch to another opioid, but at some point we're going to say this is a failed treatment.
And do you have a goal of a course? In other words, let's say someone's getting relief from their opiates for their chronic nociceptive pain. Is the goal to keep them then on it, or to at some point try to get them off it? How do you manage that? Because, if long-term use can have, consequences like hyperalgesia or other things, is the goal to get them off it eventually?
So with almost all drugs, I usually try to have if someone's on gabapentin for neuropathic pain, or they're on an SNRI or a tricyclic antidepressant for between 6 months and 12 months, and they're doing well, I'll usually try to see if I can decrease it. And if I can't, I'll go up. I mean, I ask these questions, have you ever not taken the opioids or missed a dose? Is your pain worse? And, viewing chronic pain as a disease model, similar to hypertension or diabetes, people may need to stay on these medications in the long term. But there has to be continued surveillance.
Okay. So let's turn to another kind of treatment for nociceptive pain, like for lower back pain. Sometimes you will do other kind of interventions. Tell me about that.
So again, I think it's important to categorize the pain, because the surgical and the non-surgical interventional treatments are different for neuropathic, i.e. radicular pain, and non-neuropathic pain. So this is what I teach our trainees. So if somebody has radicular pain, the most common non-interventional, interventional treatment in the world is epidural steroids. And we do in the United States about 10 million of these injections each year. So it's huge. Epidurals can actually relieve non-radicular pain, but the number needed to treat is very, very high. So they're not indicated. So in many of these patients, the risk may outweigh the benefits. For people with non-neuropathic pain. And the gold standard for separating people into neuropathic back pain and non-neuropathic back pain is physician, because the physician can do physical exam tests, can look at MRIs, can order EMG and nerve conduction studies. But there's all sorts of instruments that can be helpful to primary care doctors. So where they just give it to a patient, the patient answers a question, they just score it, and then it'll say, likely neuropathic pain, possibly neuropathic pain, unlikely to be neuropathic pain. So one of the most common is Pain Detect, but there are others such as SS-LONS. If For low back pain, it's really all over the place in terms of the prevalence of, you know, the prevalence of different etiologies. So in younger people, the discs are probably more likely to be a source of pain. Unfortunately, there is no great treatment for disc pain. People used to burn the discs. That was one of the first areas of research I ever did, something called intradiscal electrothermal therapy, where we threaded an electrode around a disc and burned the pain receptors. And that worked really well for a short period of time, but it didn't work in the long term. And there are lots of risks. There is surgical procedures, spine fusion. If you don't have, you know, posterior element pain, they'll do a disc replacement on one or two levels. Now, a big thing is basovertebral nerve ablation, which seeks to treat pain from the vertebral end plates. We have a study that's on hold. It did receive IRB approval at Johns Hopkins as a multi-center study. It's funded by the Department of Defense. It's looking at stem cells. But a court ruling 3 months ago kind of put everything on hold. But there's no really great treatments for disc pain. I had been the chair last year of the lumbar facet guidelines, and that's what I'm working on right now, cervical facet guidelines. They were published in Regional Anesthesia and Pain Medicine. And in young people, muscles and discs are much more likely to be a source of pain, or the sacroiliac joint, from injuries, than facet joints. But in older people, the prevalence of facet joint pain increases and the prevalence of disc pain and muscle pain decreases. So if you happen to have facet pain, you're lucky, because there's a minimally invasive effective treatment. So radiofrequency ablation.
Okay. So is it fair to say that for nociceptive pain, let's say you have an injury to your SI joint or you tore a ligament in your SI joint, you know, that's nociceptive, and there are interventions you can do, right? Let's say that because of that injury, there's a lot of inflammation and it's causing pain. You could do a steroid injection that might help. So there are injections, but most of the time when you think about, you know, like epidural steroid injections, you're thinking about neuropathic pain, right?
Correct.
Okay. And then the idea there is you have this inflamed nerve or inflamed nerves, and you're trying to provide some anti-inflammatory effect to let the inflammation kind of calm down and hopefully improve the pain. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay. And then
I was just saying, so the injections that we do for, let's say, facet blocks or sacroiliac joint injections, they're not only possibly therapeutic, and you can have sacroiliac joint pain and you get no long-term benefit from steroids because steroids don't work, but they're really the gold standard for diagnosis. So they're diagnostic in as well. And they may also be facilitative, so they can improve your ability to participate in physical therapy, improve your sleep, so you're more active, and it can prevent or reverse deconditioning.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. And when you say diagnostic, you mean if someone has pain and you think, gee, that might be from your SI joint, and you go and you put some local anesthetic in the SI joint and the pain gets better, that's in some ways helping with your diagnosis that, yes, in fact, that was the source of the pain.
Right. It's very helpful, but diagnostic blocks are inherently limited because let's say for lumbar facet pain in somebody who's less than 50 years old, the false positive rate of a single lumbar facet block is higher than the true prevalence rate. So in other words, if somebody has a positive block, statistically, it's more likely that it's a false positive block than
a true positive block
in certain, you know, demographic groups.
Okay, interesting. And then you mentioned radiofrequency ablation. So this is when you're actually burning the nerve roots, right, with radiofrequency?
So we wouldn't burn nerve roots. We burn nerves that don't have motor fibers, and they don't have like A beta sensory fibers. We don't want people to be weak, to have a, you know, neurologic motor weakness or numbness.
So these are then just isolated pain nerves.
Mostly. I mean, they may also have like proprioceptive properties.
Okay. And, you know, I've always thought this was so interesting. You would think that burning a nerve would cause pain, not help treat it, right? So why does it help?
So people used to do radiofrequency ablation for neuropathic pain, and it's rarely done now because of the exact reason that you brought. So if you burn a nerve, so these people with neuropathic pain, right? They had nerve injury. Maybe they had shingles. Maybe they have HIV or diabetes. But many people with those conditions don't have pain. So these people may be genetically and psychologically predisposed. And then you injure their nerves more. So first, you're injuring the nerves further, and they're already predisposed. Every time you burn or you injure a nerve, there will be a neuroma. Now, the neuroma is not always painful, but it's certainly a big source of pain. And then you can also have deafferentation pain. So when we know this from like phantom limb pain. So, you know, there's no longer a limb, but there's still pain in the phantom limb. And there's lots of reasons. There could be peripheral, spinal, and cortical mechanisms for that, like reorganization. Your body is used to receiving input from this body part and sending efferent information back out. And then all of a sudden the body part is gone or it's denervated. So we generally reserve radiofrequency ablation, you know, for nociceptive conditions where there's no, you know, normal, you know, A-beta fibers or motor fibers in the nerve.
And why does it work there? I mean, you're still causing a neuroma, right? Why does that neuroma not produce pain?
So, because it's not a primary sensory nerve, it only is transmitting nociceptive information. So you're not getting like spontaneous ectopic discharge.
Okay.
Of fibers. But you can, people do get neuritis. So they get temporary inflammation. It feels like a sunburn and it could last for, you know, for up to 2 weeks after ablation, radiofrequency ablation.
Okay. And then the other thing is that radiofrequency ablation tends not to be a permanent fix, right? So after, at least for some people, even though you've destroyed that nerve, the pain will eventually come back sometimes. And why is that? If the nerve's not there, does it regrow?
Yeah, you get re-innervation and regeneration.
Okay. All right. So we've talked about nociceptive pain, how there are obviously medications, there are certain blocks and radiofrequency ablation depending on the site and the type of pain. We've talked about neuropathic pain and how often things like epidural steroid injections can be helpful, as well as medications that are more geared towards neuropathic pain that you've mentioned. Gabapentin, for example, is commonly used for that. Antidepressants you mentioned can be used for that. How about nociplastic pain? What are the treatment modalities for that?
So a couple of things. So antidepressants are really unique. So they work different than anticonvulsants. Anticonvulsants, they're effective for seizures because they stop injured nerves in your brain from firing. And if you have injured nerves in your legs from diabetes or some other neuropathic condition, they can stop those nerves from firing. So they're not very effective for non-neuropathic or nociplastic conditions. Antidepressants, on the other hand, they work by inhibiting pain signals. So they enhance descending inhibitory signals. And because you don't have specific pathways for nociceptive, neuropathic, or nociplastic pain, they can work for all types of pain. So for nociplastic pain, in general, the same treatments for neuropathic pain are effective. So antidepressants, membrane stabilizers. There's a couple of differences between nociplastic pain and other types of pain. So people with nociplastic pain, because the primary problem is that their nervous system is overly sensitized. And like I said, they often co-occur. So in the 2010s and 2000s, you know, there were a whole bunch of studies looking at neuropathic components, different conditions like arthritis or degenerative disc disease. And they usually came up with numbers like 10 to 15% of degenerative disc disease or knee arthritis is neuropathic in nature. We know that those are probably now, they're partially nociplastic in nature. So nociplastic pain can co-occur with some, with other conditions. People with a sensitive nervous system can really have arthritis. They can herniate discs and have sciatica. But in general, with nociplastic pain, injections and surgery are usually not very effective. There's a high failure rate. One other difference in nociplastic pain is you have to be very, very careful about putting these people on opioids, because there's some evidence that people with, let's say, fibromyalgia, they have high endogenous levels of opioids to begin with. So giving them more opioids is not likely to be effective. And again, opioids, they're basically hyperalgesic at baseline. And giving them more opioids, which can cause hyperalgesia, is not going to help.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what is the kind of mainstay of treatment for nociplastic pain? Is it antidepressants?
So, I mean, there are lots of different classes of treatments, and pharmacological drugs are just one of those classes. So you have to try to, so that is one. Antidepressants, membrane stabilizers are also effective. There's a high co-prevalence rate of sleep abnormalities in people with with chronic pain in general, but especially with nociplastic pain. And if you're sleep deprived, it actually increases your pain sensitivity. So you have to kind of address some of these things. A lot of them are deconditioned. So low impact aerobic exercise is really important, because it can prevent or even reverse deconditioning. People who exercise may sleep better. And that's a big, huge problem, especially stage 4 sleep dysfunction in people with nociplastic conditions. It can help with weight gain. It stimulates your natural endorphin.
Yeah. Okay. So lots of things. Well, you mentioned membrane stabilizers. Give me an example of that.
Anticonvulsants, okay. Like gabapentinoids.
Gotcha. Okay. So this is great. And I think, you know, obviously we could talk about any of these things a lot more, but this, I think, is a really helpful way to kind of categorize it and think about some of the treatments along the way for each of these. Let's talk about what's on the horizon. What do you think we're going to see in the next 20, 30 years when it comes to treatment of different kinds of pain?
So I think that in the future, pain medicine will be more personalized. In other words, treatments not merely based on symptoms, imaging, or even diagnosis, but on unique phenotypic, maybe even genotypic characteristics of each patient. The future will hopefully provide a framework for instituting an interdisciplinary approach to pain management in a practical and cost-effective manner. So there's some evidence that interdisciplinary approaches to pain are more effective than, unimodal approaches. The problem is that they're not cost-effective. So this could involve individually tailored psychotherapy, not only for individuals with chronic pain, but for those with acute pain at high risk of transitioning to chronic pain, and even for vulnerable patients before high-risk surgeries. It will probably involve more biological therapies, such as monoclonal antibodies and regenerative therapies that address the underlying mechanisms of chronic pain rather than just the symptoms. In other words, these could be disease-modifying agents. In general, pharmacological treatment, I think I brought this up before, you know, maybe mechanism-based rather than disease or etiological-based, and involve precision-targeted treatments with minimal off-target effects. For example, there's many, many different types, more than a dozen, of sodium channels. But only some of them are really implicated in pain. So if we target some of these sodium channel subunits rather than all sodium channels, there can be less side effects and they're better tolerated. I also think that, you know, we have a perverse reimbursement system in the United States, and it rewards the indiscriminate use of injections and surgeries. And I think that that has to change because it's not sustainable. Not only is it not sustainable, but it has an adverse effect on access to care for other people, because it's almost the default position that insurance companies just deny treatment. So I think that there has to be some type of physician accountability for outcomes in whatever form is logistically feasible.
Yeah. So what about, that's great. What about, you know, I think in psychiatry, there's just a ton of interesting things coming out around alternative treatments for things like trauma, PTSD, depression. So I think there's now, and I'm sure you know this better than I do, but I think there's now maybe it's a nasal inhaled ketamine treatment for depression. I know there's a ton of work being done here at Hopkins and elsewhere on psychedelics for PTSD. It seems like there's a new article coming out about that almost every day. Is any of this, in the sense that I guess there's always, as we've been talking about, the biopsychosocial model, right? If you can treat the psychological conditions, you're going to help the pain too. Is there any thought that any of this stuff will be in use on an outpatient basis for chronic pain in the future?
So that's a really great point. So some of the first studies ever for chronic pain, I remember one in the early 1960s in Lancet for headache, looking at antidepressants, where it was a controlled trial. So almost everything that's effective for depression is effective for pain. So ketamine, antidepressants, things like RTMS, which is repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, DCS, electroconvulsive therapy in certain contexts. And it's really interesting because I was also the chair of the ketamine guidelines from the ASA and AAPM in 2018. Ketamine is a really fascinating drug because you can do surgery with ketamine. You can amputate a foot with ketamine because of its anesthetic properties. And there's multiple studies that look at quantitative sensory testing with ketamine. Quantitative sensory testing is when you're looking at pain thresholds, pain tolerance to all different stimuli, like chemical, could be, you know, heat, cold, mechanical. And some people who get ketamine, and it's very dose dependent, will have intermediate term benefit. So they'll have pain relief 4 weeks. But there's over half a dozen studies that look at quantitative sensory testing for ketamine after 48 hours, and almost all of them show no difference. So in other words, ketamine, 48 hours, it's a drug with a short half-life. So 48 hours later does not result in higher pain threshold or pain tolerance for almost any stimuli, but some people feel better. And that's because probably in the long term, this is my opinion, ketamine, there are different components of pain. So the one that we're most familiar with as anesthesiologists is the sensory discriminative component. But there's also affective, motivational component, i.e. the emotional part of pain. And there's a cognitive evaluative component. And that's why people with cancer pain, it's really, really awful. So there's more nerves, more pain nerves are firing after surgery than with cancer, right? There's no specific cancer pain pathways. The FDA said many times, right? There's no pathophysiological basis for cancer pain to be different than, you know, non-cancer chronic pain. The difference is in this cognitive evaluative thing. People with cancer know that they may not get better. So I think the ketamine works more on this affective component of pain.
Okay. How about psychedelics?
Well, ketamine is also a psychedelic. So drugs, it works on the same receptor as phencyclidine or PCP. And so that's also a really, really big area. And I believe that there's more evidence, probably in the long term at least, because some of them work on the sensory discriminative component as well, and they could raise pain thresholds. But probably it's because of this affective motivational component, maybe even the cognitive component, like how you view pain.
Okay. And is that similar also to MDMA and psilocybin?
They're all a little different, but I think that most of them probably in the long term will work more on the non-sensory discriminative components.
Okay. Well, it will be interesting to see. Well, Steve, thank you. This has been really great. Thank you so much for taking the time. Let's move to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Do you have something that you have been listening to or reading or checking out lately that you would recommend to the audience?
So we recently got Netflix, and my wife, Karen, and I were watching two series, and they're wonderful. One we just finished, which is Queen's Gambit. And it's really relevant because I used to follow chess. I used to play chess. I have two great kids, maybe a little on the nerdy side, and they're interested in chess. And it's wonderful. And the other show that we're watching is called Shtisel. It's an Israeli show. There are subtitles, but it's internationally acclaimed.
Yeah, I've watched Queen's Gambit. I agree with you. Amazing show. I have heard a lot about Shtisel, but I haven't seen it. So I'll put that on my list as well. Great recommendations. And, you know, I'll recommend something a little different that if folks don't already get this or haven't checked it out, the New York Times has a morning newsletter and you can sign up for it and it'll appear in your inbox every morning. It's written primarily by a guy named David Leonhardt, and it's just so well done. It's short. I read it while I'm walking from my car to my office every morning. So it probably takes about, you know, while you're walking and paying attention to other things, 10 minutes, if you were just standing still reading it, you could probably do it in 5, but it's a nice encapsulation of kind of what's going on in this country and the world. Just some interesting facts about a couple different things. He usually focuses on one major topic and then gives you some updates on other ones. It's a nice little piece of news to just catch up on things each morning. So I recommend checking that out. All right, Steve, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Jed. And have a great weekend.
All right. That was fantastic. Such a great opportunity to learn from one of the true gurus in the field. Hopefully you enjoyed it as much as I did. Let us know what you thought. Go to acrack.com. You can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. I'm at Jay Walpaw, and we're at Acrack Podcast. And we also have a Facebook group and an Instagram page. We're doing great stuff. Check it out. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you're interested in supporting the making of the show, you can go to patreon.com/acrack. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make individual donations anytime you want by going to paypal.me/acrack or looking up Jay Walpaw or Jed Walpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really, really appreciate it. Huge thanks, as always, to our tech lead, Dr. Brian Park, to our social media manager, Ryan Okonski, and to our production assistants, Dr. Kimmy Akashkuli and Dr. April Liu. We could not do it without them. And a big thank you, of course, to the man who composed our original ACRAC music, Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast and Dr. Steve Cohen, I'm Jed Walpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.